serving or sharing will come to be treated as another form of the dole. That is, as it is cut back, you will find municipalities like New York that are unwilling and unable to solve their problems by going back to the tax rates that they should have maintained all the time. There are intelligently supervised communities which are using any federal income that comes to them to make the one-time capital improvements that do not interfere with the chain of expenditures that the municipality itself has traditionally been accustomed to making.
You mentioned tax reforms. Would you like to comment on some of your views on tax reform?
Yeah, I think that the problem is, there are two sets of problems with regard to income taxes. First, I don't know of anybody who believes that it's easy to make out an income tax return. I think it has been made infernally complicated, and so much so that as I travel around, I find many, many Virginians just believing that there's got to be something that's corrupted in the system. It's so infernally complex. I think we've got to simplify it. Second, I believe that we cannot have a soak the rich kind of a system, but I believe we have got to have a system in which the rate that people are taxed does not lead to higher rates being charged to the lower end of the spectrum. At the present time, because of the tax shelter capability, the very wealthy are able to avoid paying any income tax, whereas those who don't have the money to set up an income tax shelter are paying a much higher rate. I think that the answer to that may well be some kind of a uniform rate for a certain percentage of income.
How do you feel about the super carriers? They seem like silly targets to me. A lot of money for one bomb could wipe out the whole thing.
Well, you have to examine the problem of the super carrier in three frames of reference, I think. First, in a strategic nuclear war. Anything that gets hit in a strategic nuclear war is gone, whether it be the city of Blackstone or
That's
whether it
tail.
Be
this is on roll number
Fort
two,
Pickens
on roll number two.
Or whether
We're
it be the aircraft carrier. I'd rather be on a moving target than any fixed target. Once the nuclear warheads begin to fly, some moving targets will survive, but anything that gets hit won't. A carrier is not important in a strategic nuclear war. If that's your only concern, do away with the carriers. A conventional war is the second frame of reference. In a conventional war, look at the record. In Southeast Asia, we sent carriers into the Gulf of Tonkin. They spent 9 years there. They covered the landings. They covered the withdrawals. We lost 400 aircraft destroyed by the enemy on the ground on land airfields, and 4,000 damaged. The enemy never damaged an aircraft on an aircraft carrier. The Korean War, all of the land fields were overrun in the first few weeks. The aircraft carriers saved the Pusan perimeter and covered the landings at Incheon that turned the war around. You got to go all the way back to World War II to find a conventional war where the carriers were attacked. There, the oldest aircraft carrier today was the newest, the Essex class, in World War II. They were hit by as many as four of the most intelligent cruise missile we've ever had, the Kamikaze aircraft, and the Essex class carrier never sank. Since then, the more modern carriers have had much more survivability built into them. The most recent laboratory case was the tragic fire on the nuclear carrier Enterprise, where the equivalent of 8 or 9 cruise missiles, U.S. bombs, exploded, and the Enterprise could have been back in action in a very few hours. You got to go all the way back then to the third frame of reference, a Cold War. We're giving up land fields all around the world. 1,100 at the end of World War II. We're down to about 50 overseas today. We've never had to turn an aircraft carrier over to the enemy in Cold War. And time after time in the crisis, it is the aircraft carrier that pulls our chestnuts out of the fire. Jordan, we reinforced the 6th Fleet with aircraft carriers. Yom Kippur War, we reinforced it with aircraft carriers. The Allies stood aside. Not a single Allied airfield was available to us. We were not permitted to have U.S. Air Force aircraft in Turkey or Greece. Their aircraft were not available. The aircraft carriers were the only relevant power. So in crisis after crisis, Three different presidents have said to me personally the aircraft carriers were irreplaceable to them. Now, for that kind of crisis management, we can get by, in my judgment, with a cheaper variant than the multi-billion dollar beast we're building today. And I fought very hard for a sea control ship, a flat top that would carry about 17 aircraft, and we could have afforded 8 of those for the price of a nuclear aircraft carrier. The Congress killed it because it wasn't nuclear propelled. The nuclear lobby.
What can you do to, as one new senator, to compensate for this change? I mean, how much leverage can one person, a new senator, labor in changing this defense problem?
There's an immense amount that a freshman senator can do. Let me give you two examples of freshman senators who have done very good jobs. One is Senator Jim Buckley of New York, who has become one of the two great strategic nuclear experts and has done much to publicize the rapid decline in our strategic nuclear capability. The other is Senator Sam Nunn of Georgia, who has become quite an expert in the conventional military balance and has struck some good blows for sensible defense policies on that side. As a member of the Armed Services Committee, my opponent has never asked for a hearing to get at the facts, not even when Schlesinger was fired and known to have been fired for having tried to get the facts out. Not even after the articles by Schlesinger in the Fortune magazine appeared, or the articles by Nitze crediting the Soviets with a strategic nuclear war-winning capability. Not even after I testified in front of the Pike Committee that Kissinger has twisted the intelligence and ordered that the Secretary of State, when he was not the Secretary of State, not be informed of Soviet violations, did the Senate Armed Services Committee request a hearing. As a member of the Senate, I would demand that hearings be held on facts like that in order to publicize the true situation and to get at the generation of a consensus which can only come from public education.
What is the general feeling of the Congress and the people in Washington about the evident power shortage that we have? Are they content with the status quo, or do they want to turn this thing around and put us on top?
The people in Washington? Well, I think, you know, that depends on who one talks to.
I'm speaking of the congressmen, people who are in a position to make changes.
Let me answer it this way. When I was chief of naval operations, I tried every year to call on every member of the Congress. I averaged 85 of the 100 senators, and I averaged 350 of the 435 representatives in ones and twos and threes. They broke down, if you included the ones who wouldn't see me, into three equal categories. One third would say things like, look, I'm as worried as you are. Don't waste any time on me. Get out and get the others. Another third would turn off the switch when you walked in, if they would see you at all. Didn't believe that military power was relevant. Unfortunately, you could never get the Russians to share that view, but they sincerely believed that military power was irrelevant. And then there was a middle third that would say things like, look, I'm worried, and I believe you, but if I vote for you, I won't be here next time. And within that third, there was a subset that would go so far as to say, look, I've got to have a 30% a 30% pro-defense, 70% anti-defense record. You tell me which 30% to vote for. Now, they were handy to have in your hip pocket, and we saved the most important submarine system we've got, the Trident submarine, by a 49-47 vote by casting some of those proxies. But think of the immorality of a man who doesn't care what he votes for as long as I rack up a 30-70 record for him. Now, until you turn around the constituencies of that middle immoral third, you're not going to get the support for adequate defense budgets, and that means public education. And the tragedy is, and this is why I continue to talk about the dissembling of the Kissinger administration, there is what I call a disinformation process, a process of deliberately misleading the Congress and the public about what the facts are. If we could ever get ourselves a Secretary of State who was willing to be honest with us, and ever get ourselves a president who was willing to try to read deeply enough into the facts to get beyond the captive nature of his relationship to the Secretary of State, so that the American people began to see what Nitze, Schlesinger, Zumwalt, and others are saying, that we have let ourselves become number two, it'll turn around like lightning. Because there's one thing that Americans understand, and that's the difference between number one and number two. When I have traveled around in the last 2 years all around the United States visiting college campuses, I've been on about 24 now, I generally start off by saying, first, how many of you believe that we can cut our defense budgets? And almost every hand goes up. And then I ask, how many here believe we should be inferior to the Soviet Union? And only the two or three duty socialists put their hand up. The rest of them don't want to be number two, even on the campuses. And then when you proceed to explain to them what the facts are, the general reaction even on the campus is, why the heck aren't we doing something about it? Once the American people understand what has happened, this thing is going to turn around. But it takes getting at the facts. That's why at the Democratic National Convention, when I presented the defense platform, I came down hardest on the need for careful assessment of the facts based on a free and open system rather than the disinformation program we've had for the last 8 years.
Is this trend turning around?
This year, the Congress, for the first time, almost added some money to the president's defense budgets. They've generally averaged about $6 billion worth of cuts. That says to me that that middle third is beginning to sense from its constituencies that they're getting restless. And I think next year, after this presidential race is over, we may well see a turnaround in that picture.
Nuclear speaking, where does China fit in with us? And what is their relationship between the Soviet Union and with us?
The Chinese have got to be considered, in my judgment, as de jure members of the Communist bloc, but de facto allies of the United States. That is, for the last several years, one could have considered them that. Let me give you an example. When I was in Iceland, 2 or 3 months before I finished my four-year term, urging the Icelandic parliament to let us keep our base there, I spoke to about a third of the members of the Althing one night, and I said, I don't know this, but I would wager that the Chinese ambassador to Iceland is urging you to let us keep our base here, and they all nodded. It wasn't such a shrewd guess because I did know that the Chinese ambassadors to Turkey, Greece, and Cyprus were urging them to get along in order to keep NATO strong. I've been saying for the last several years that the Chinese were the best NATO ally we have because they understand the importance of a strong NATO as a counterweight to the 50 Soviet divisions that are along the Chinese border. The Chinese have made it clear that they welcome the continuing presence of U.S. troops in Korea, Japan, Thailand while they were there, even Taiwan, the Philippines, because they are so desperately afraid of the Soviet military power. While we're putting 5% of our gross national product into military, and while the Soviets are outspending us in dollars by putting 15% of theirs, the Chinese are desperately struggling, less dollars, by putting 20% of their GNP into military. They're scrambling to get missiles to sea to avoid nuclear castration, and they're scrambling to get tactical air to build up with their superior manpower. Now, there have been some signals in recent months that are ominous, signals that indicate that the Chinese are considering whether or not they can continue this de facto alliance with us. The first of these was that they announced they were liquidating their support of the third faction in Angola. When they saw the handwriting on the wall there with the Soviet demonstration of power. So the second was their sudden decision that the Soviet helicopter crew that they had held prisoner for 2 years hadn't been spying after all, and they released it. The third was their insulting of President Ford when he was in China and their expression of horror when he fired Schlesinger. As the one man in the cabinet whom they felt understood what the Russians were up to and was trying to get the facts out. And the final signal was their invitation to Mr. Nixon to visit China, which was designed to infuriate Mr. Ford.
I'd like to ask you about consolidation of helicopter training at Fort Rucker and also your views on women in the service academies.
Okay, with regard to consolidation of helicopter training, I think that the thing that we have to worry about in the services is the increasing effort to create a single service. In those countries that have tried it, it's been a disaster. And in Canada, where they've lived with it for a few years, they're gradually beginning to separate the services again. Now, in order to avoid that tragedy, one has to make every possible effort to achieve efficiencies by consolidating the three services, getting together to consolidate where it's intelligent to do so, and not to consolidate where it's not intelligent to do so, because the missions differ. The three services, up until the time I retired, had begun to make progress, and I believe they are continuing to, at getting together through their three logistics commanders to work out these kinds of consolidations, and I suspect that helicopter training is one where it makes sense to do it. Now, the kind of a situation in which one would have to be cautious, I think, is where special training is required. You can never do naval aviation training under an Air Force because of the carrier problem. But, right, just the basic training is the place to consolidate, I think.
And then the women.
With regard to women, I was, I guess, the one member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff who favored women going to the service academies, as a result of which Mr. Nixon sent over the word when the Congress was going to hold hearings in 1974 that I was not to testify, but rather to send my number two, who it was known opposed women going to the Naval Academy. They therefore had unanimous testimony against it, whereupon Congress promptly authorized it. I don't think that it's going to make the difference between Tweedledee and Tweedledum, and it eliminates the source of friction. The great argument used against it was that you can't send women into combat. But we have always had a large fraction of graduates of the service academies go into non-combat kinds of specialties, and the women will merely be a small subset of that fraction.
Do you consider yourself a conservative or liberal?
I have trouble with what I am, because I try to come out with what I think is the right answer on each issue, and sometimes that has me on the conservative side, and sometimes it has me on the moderate side. I think that those labels are overworked. Although on a given issue, I suppose I could tell you where I am.
What about national health insurance? I heard you mention it. I'm in the health field. I'd like to know what you're thinking of.
I'm serving on the board of the American Health Foundation, which is a board that specializes in preventive medicine. And one of the things I'm convinced of, after going through the cost statistics for about a year and a half, is that we can save the country money in the medical field if we have an intelligent preventive medicine program, and that if we phase that in properly, we can reduce overall costs to the country. Now, what do I mean by that? We know today that if we have the opportunity to give a positive physical examination every year to everybody, we can pick up a lot of incipient disease. Early hardening of the arteries, early proneness toward heart attack, that kind of thing. I believe it's possible to phase in sensible medical programs using private insurance systems, not socialized medicine, in a way that will, at the very least, provide care for catastrophic illness, which today is destroying families when they run into a long string of bad luck, and which over time can probably go further as we begin to generate savings through a preventive medicine system. I don't think we can afford to authorize an across-the-board national medical care. I think you've got to do it in an intelligent and business-like way to take advantage of the savings that I believe we'll demonstrate.
Do you feel that the current manpower through the schools, medical schools, dental schools, pharmacy schools, as such, do you think that we can provide the health care for our nation in the future without increasing our enrollment now?
The issue, I think, comes down to whether or not the free enterprise system is being permitted to operate in accordance with supply and demand, or whether the constraints put upon the institutions that train the health sciences are such that supply cannot respond to demand. I believe that that's the place to examine and to look for intelligent and efficient ways to make it easier for supply to respond to demand if that is a problem. The studies that I last examined, which I suppose were now 2.5 years out of date, indicated to me that the system still did have the capability to respond and was beginning to respond with some help, such as the Armed Services Medical Academy, which has now been authorized, and such as the subsidized internships that the services have been authorized to have, which over time will add to civilian sources.
Then how do you feel about Senator Kennedy's bill requiring a certain percentage of the interim medical classes to be only allowed to practice in areas where the government says they can go?
Well, I always
areas.
I always worry about a system that begins to prescribe where people must go and how they must live and that sort of thing. I'd want to use that as a last resort if it turned out that we were simply unable to provide adequate medical care in significant geographical regions of the country. And I'd like to see us examine economic incentives long before we went into a mandatory assignment system.
What's your position on the right to work?
I've publicly stated time and time again that I favor the continuation of the present law.
Admiral, I know you've been expecting this question. We have heard and read a lot in the news media lately that much of your support is coming from out of state, from AFL-CIO and so forth. Would you care to comment on that?
Yeah, I call that a bird cocktail, a jigger of fact and a glass full of fiction. In the following sense, I think he's first one of the few that's really interested in the problem, but an accurate formulation of the phenomenon, in my judgment, would be as follows. First, I have a larger number of Virginians who have contributed to me than he has who have contributed to him. Second, about 78% of my contributors are Virginians, and that's a larger percentage than his. I think. I'm not sure of that, but I think so. Third, both Senator Byrd and I are accepting money from out of state. Fourth, I have received more money from out of state than he has received. Now, the reason for that is that he has a lock on the people who, over the years, have given big money from within the state. I am matching that with friends around the United States whom I have accumulated over the years, as he has accumulated them from within Virginia, who are contributing large individual sums to match those that he gets.